One of the first things that people say is, you know, like, Dr. Sarita, I haven't gone to jail since I started Safe Supply. I was in jail, you know, every other month. I have one man who's only 32 years old, and he says he spent 13 years of those 32 years in jail. But since he started the program 4 years ago, he hasn't gone once. And so we're seeing the impacts of that, not just on the individual, on a personal level.
This is the Public Health Insight Podcast. Before we move on, it is important to note that the views expressed in this podcast are our own and do not represent any of the organizations we work for or are affiliated with.
In the previous episode, Gordon and Ben spoke with Dr. Andrea Sarita about the genesis of the drug poisoning crisis, its similarity to the alcohol prohibition period, some reasons people use opioids and other substances, and COVID-19's impact on harm reduction services. In the second part of the discussion, Dr. Sarita remains with us to share her experience as a lead physician practicing street outreach medicine to support people who use street-level drugs, people living in homelessness, and women involved in the survival sex trade. They conclude the conversation by talking about the London Intercommunity Health Centre's Safe Opioid Supply Program, which is currently the longest running of its kind in Canada. This is where they left off.
This contextualized the conversation really well, and I think it's a perfect time to even talk about specifically more about the work that you do. A lot of people might say, you know, giving more drugs to people who are already using drugs, that's crazy. So can you tell us why that's actually not crazy?
Yeah. So again, the perception that I'm giving more drugs. No, I'm just giving much safer drugs. Right. Again, people are going to use drugs. Making it illegal doesn't change a god darn thing. Right. I'm just giving them the safer version thereof. So my Safer Supply program actually emerged in early 2016 for a group of folks who nothing standard was working for them, right? Our standard treatment interventions of, you know, abstinence or methadone or buprenorphine, which is Suboxone, they weren't, you know, making these people well for a variety of reasons. And these folks were always suffering complications from their drug use, whether it's from, you know, significant infections or overdose. In our local hospital system in London, there was a physician who was using intravenous hydromorphone, which is what I'm prescribing for Safer Supply, a version of that. And the goal of that was actually to support people's drug use and withdrawal needs while they were in hospital so that they could remain in hospital and then complete their treatment. And this physician would often send people home with weaning oral prescriptions for an opioid medication. And often these were my patients. And what I would see during that time period of 4 to 6 weeks while they were in possession of this prescription is they would continue to do well. They wouldn't overdose. They wouldn't be back in hospital. They would attend appointments for me. We would get stuff done. And then that prescription would run out and they'd return to what their life was before, which was this constant cycle of intoxication and withdrawal and the hustle they needed to purchase their drugs on the street. And it was a really profound comparison of before and after. And so at that point, again, with the risk of these folks dying, I kind of took a leap. I was pretty darn scared. Nobody else was doing this as far as I knew. And all I did was continue those prescriptions. That's it. And people got better and they stayed better. And after that first group of a small group of patients, I did it for a few more and a few more and a few more and saw the same dramatic outcomes. And so here we are in London, Ontario with, you know, over 300 people on Safer Supply, you know, fully funded by Health Canada, with Health Canada recognizing this as an approach to street level substance use, and with Safer Supply, you know, spreading across the country. So to our critics, we're not giving more drugs. We're giving safer drugs. We're supporting people in a harm reduction capacity in their own choice to continue using drugs because of all the reasons we discussed in the first half of this podcast. We're just allowing them to do it in a way that results in less harm.
So that almost brings it back full circle to the problem statement. So that specific solution recognizes that there is drug poisonings happening, and one of the solutions to drug poisonings is to have medical grade supplies that there is no risk of something unknown causing adverse health outcomes. Is that kind of how that came about?
Yes. So we're replacing people's street level volatile unknown concentration drugs with a pill that they know exactly what they're getting. They know how it makes them feel. They know if they use two, they get this. They know that their absolute threshold is three. Just like going to the bar. People know what they're going to get. They know how much it takes to get drunk. They know when to stop. That's the same thing with Safe Supply. People know what they're getting. And in 5 years of Safer Supply, I have not had a single patient overdose on their prescribed Safer Supply. Not one. And that's because people know what they're getting.
So that literally is evidence to suggest that through a prescription, the patient gets filled a prescription, whether it's for 2 weeks at a time, 30 days at a time, or however long, they're not going to just consume all the amount that they have. That's a false assumption. And your program is a testament that that's not actually what happens.
No. And certainly the vast majority of people on Safe Supply are on a daily dispense prescription. And that's for a lot of reasons, right? So initially when people join the program, they're used to the hustle. So people, you know, depending on the amount of money, most people use whatever they can afford, and that changes day to day. So we do see early in the program, it takes people some time to trust that they're going to get their supply, to trust that it's going to take them through a 24-hour period. But once they do that, it's amazing how they stabilize in their volume of use. And so, again, the vast majority of people remain on daily dispense, both to help them manage, but also, you know, especially if they're living on the street, to keep them safer with a shorter supply of drugs. But as people stabilize, as they move into housing, as their substance use becomes predictable and stable, then some people do move on to picking up 1 week at a time. 1 week is a maximum that we do on Safer Supply. We focus on overdose a lot. And drug poisoning fatalities. But there's so many other things that go along with injection drug use related to the volatile, unpredictable, and tainted and dirty supply, right? And so it's not just overdoses that we're targeting. We're also targeting infections related to drug use. And again, when people have a known substance prepared in a sterile fashion and we teach them how to do it in the safest way possible, we've seen a dramatic reduction in, you know, HIV acquisition, hepatitis C transmission, infections of the skin and the heart, it's just tanked. It's gotten so much better, again, because we're giving people something that is safer.
Absolutely, empowering them. Mm-hmm. And then adding on to that, you know, we talked about this earlier in terms of your practice brings you into contact, you know, with people who use drugs, people who live in homelessness, women who are involved in the survival sex trade. Can you tell us about some of the unique challenges that these specific populations face in your care and some of the biggest misconceptions that people have about them?
That's a big question too. I mean, we already talked a bit about people who are living in homelessness and kind of, you know, the cause and effect and, you know, what's chicken and egg here. And that's ongoing. Certainly a challenge is that we are also in a housing crisis, right? So earlier in the program in, you know, 2016 and 2017, London, Ontario actually had a kind of reasonable vacancy rate for rental units and, you know, not unreasonable rents. That shifted in 2018 when our vacancy rate was, you know, less than 1%. Our rates skyrocketed above $1,000. I think the average one bedroom in London is now like $1,300. And so people living in homelessness on a social assistance income, even if they find something, they can't afford it and they can't even find it, right? So I mean, people who are, you know, have a traditional income and are coming from their own housing, there's still apartment wars, right? People will throw deposits on apartments without even seeing them. That's how hard it is to get somewhere to live. And that's not just in London, that's across Canada. So we've really seen a real shift in our ability to get people into safe and appropriate housing. So that remains a challenge. Folks who use substances are faced with the ever-changing supply. So again, just like alcohol, we're going from an unconcentrated product to a more concentrated product. The same is happening with fentanyl, right? So people who are mixing and creating the batches are finding different ways to cut the fentanyl, different substances that they can use either, you know, for failure and volume or for other effects. And something that we've seen emerge in the past 2 years is a very significant cut of benzodiazepines in the fentanyl. And benzos are, you know, your Valiums, your Ativans, that type of drug, right? And so it's very dangerous for you know, multiple of the reasons other than fentanyl. But now we're also having people who use street-level drugs who have a dual dependence on both opioids and benzodiazepines. And that's really complicating how we help people. Women in the sex trade, their challenges are very parallel to everyone else, right? So they're generating an income in a profession that is criminalized. And so they're again forced to work on the black market, work in ways that are under the table. And that creates many, 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 many safety risks for those folks. And again, with COVID, you know, their job of sex work is more dangerous by the fact that they have to come in contact, direct contact with folks, right? And that's an ongoing challenge that we seek to, you know, help the women navigate through.
So there's a lot of, you touch on this a lot in a lot of conversations that you have, that it's a lot of the problems we have are because of the way we treat the perceived problem. So if we keep criminalizing activities we don't want, we get further away from actually solving the problem. Is that, Does that sum up a lot of what your observations are?
I mean, reflect on what I told you, the problems. The problems are actually things that the rest of us did to people who are engaged in these criminalized activities, right? You know, making opioids and other lists, like it forces people into volatile, you know, criminalizing an entire profession forces them to do it in unsafe ways. The consequences of that aren't necessarily or not even usually due to the activity itself. It's about these false parameters that we as a society, that our laws place around these activities, that come from a prohibitionist, like, certain moral standard that people are applying to these things, that are actually hurting those who engage in these activities. None of our laws have, you know, helped or you know, made things better for people. All they do is, you know, send them underground, because people are not going to stop doing drugs. People are not going to stop doing sex work. So we need to stop throwing barriers up that make that so much unsafer for the people involved.
Absolutely. And speaking of even going a higher level up and talking about stereotypes and misconceptions again, there are a lot of groups or populations that are disproportionately impacted by, you know, the negative outcomes associated with drug use. And one of the ones that I found out recently that people might not even expect are construction workers. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you could speak to a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And this is, you know, the construction trade is something that we've known about for a while. The CDC in the United States has reported on this for some time. But a recent coroner's report coming out of Ontario was the first time that we've documented it here in this province, to my knowledge. And what came out of that data is looking at men between, again, I think it was between ages of 30 and 49, approximately. Over 30% of those overdoses in that age bracket were men in the construction industry. And so that's for lots of reasons as well. Construction is a very physically demanding job with lots of injuries, lots of, you know, acute discrete injuries, but then, you know, chronic injuries and chronic problems that arise from that within the context of a prescribing milieu where doctors say that we can't really treat your pain. So you've got a guy going to work, supporting his family in, you know, really heavy laboring work, and his hip and his back really hurt because of this, you know, time he got pinned under the crane or whatever 5 years ago, and he can't get ongoing, you know, medical therapy for that. what is he going to do? He's got to go to work. He's got to feed his family. He's got to pay his mortgage. So he's going to do what he needs to do to treat that pain. And right now, unfortunately, a lot of the time that's the street market. And, you know, the street market is fentanyl right now. And so you're seeing, you know, these working folks, again, also become dependent on the illicit market and then suffer the same drug poisoning consequences as all the other folks.
Definitely. And honing in again on the safe opioid supply program, you know, bringing it all together, there are positive outcomes that have been documented as a result of this. You did mention that in your practice that you've seen that it was able to effectively reduce the number of overdoses to zero, indicating, reinforcing that, hey, it's actually a drug poisoning problem for rather than an overdose problem once you take away those barriers. But I was wondering if you could speak to, do we have any documented evidence regarding SOS on things like criminal activity?
Yes.
You know, people's access to housing, because there is, you know, just give you the floor to speak about some of those positive outcomes. Mm-hmm.
So as I mentioned, in the first couple of years of the program, when we still had housing stock, we absolutely saw a huge number of people moved into supportive housing. And in those first 2 years, we were able to actually house about 60% of people coming onto the program. But when you're talking about criminalized behavior, and I very specifically am choosing to call it criminalized instead of criminal behavior, where people are seeking to earn money and the only ways available to them, and often that's in ways that, again, we criminalize, such as boosting or car theft or panhandling or other. When people have a prescription, they no longer have to do that hustle. They no longer have to do that criminalized behavior to support their own needs. And so one of the first things that people say is, you know, like, Dr. Sarita, I haven't gone to jail since I started Safe Supply. I was in jail, you know, every other month. I have one man who's only 32 years old, and he says he spent 13 years of those 32 years in jail, but since he started the program 4 years ago, he hasn't gone once. And so we're seeing the impacts of that, not just on the individual on a personal level, but if you think about all, you know, the money that is saved by preventing those incarcerations and preventing the street level policing that's needed to go around that. We see, you know, a parallel thing around women involved in the survival sex trade. So, we firmly believe that sex work is a choice and that women can generate income that way and in a way that they choose to do for themselves. But by getting a safer supply of medication, of opioids, that's no longer a driver. So we see women out on the street less. They can choose to work in safer ways because there's not that like deep need to be able to get their next dose. They can choose to do it in safer ways. They can sometimes, again, if they become housed, choose to do that in a safer place, such as their home. So by giving them a safer prescription, they're also able to make safer choices within their day-to-day life.
Those are great evidence points. And my question is, is there any limitations to this program that you've noticed? Anything that you'd hope to improve?
Right. Capacity is the issue.
Yeah, sort of like lessons learned, if you will.
Lessons learned, yeah. Lessons learned on an individual programmatic level is capacity. For example, in London, Ontario, we know we have at least 6,000 people who inject drugs, and my program has 300. So it's a drop in the bucket, and we're the biggest program in Canada. And there's programs unrolling, but they face the same issues. We only have a tiny corner of people helped out of the vast ocean of people who could use this support. But in terms of, you know, learnings from a programmatic level, I would say it, as providers, we've learned about ourselves. So even though we're practicing, you know, in a medical practice that firmly embraces the concept of harm reduction, I think we've all been challenged to really put our money where our mouth is, right? And if we're practicing harm reduction, that also means supporting people's autonomy of choice, not you know, using the hierarchical, you know, relationship that's usually between doctor and patient, really learning that people's choices are their own, they're valid, and our job is to support that in a safer way. So again, even though we started the program with that concept, I think every single day we're challenged to put patients first and not the structure and the beliefs of the system.
So how is this program essentially similar or different for those who are more familiar with things like methadone, medical assisted therapy for, you know, opioid replacement? How is this different, the same? Is it complementary? Could you just help us to align where those fall?
It's all of the above, actually. So methadone and buprenorphine, which is again Suboxone, are substitution therapies, right? So they're taking people who are dependent on an illicit supply, giving them a prescribed safe supply of an opioid of a known dose and known concentration to divert them from the contaminated street supply. In that way, traditional therapies like methadone are no different than the program that I practice around safer opioid supply. And there's a lot of people who have stabilized on methadone, Suboxone, and when it works for those folks, it really works. It decreases mortality, it decreases morbidity. People are really well when it works for them. And that's the same as safe supply, right? Where we're different is, I think methadone has, and I want to speak generally because there's so many absolutely amazing, excellent methadone doctors across the country. But I think methadone historically has some challenge, not methadone the drug, the program, has some challenges again around respecting people's autonomy. So traditional opioid substitution is really a carceral model. People are expected to do what the program says they have to do. They're policed through urine toxicology. They're often, you know, subjected to really inhumane things like observed urine samples. Their choices are often infantilized in my experience. So again, we talked about why people might use street level drugs. That's just a no-no without a recognition that people have their own needs to meet. So in that model, safer supply is different in that it centers the patient's own choices in their substitution therapy. That doesn't mean we give them whatever they want, but they define their goals. The doctor in the program does not define their own goals. So I strongly believe that, you know, physicians prescribing methadone and bup and physicians prescribing safe supply need to work really closely together because they do work together. Often people want both. They want that backbone of methadone or bup, but then they're meeting their own needs. And there's no reason we can't put them together to really, really create an excellent support for people.
So, bringing it full circle again, this is an innovative approach, and it seems like people are in this field are understanding that it's a very complicated, intertwined problem that requires really a multi-pronged approach from everything from, you know, SOS itself to housing first to, you know, just a putting, you know, patient-centered care, people-centered care, humanizing people. So are there any other innovative, cutting-edge, non-traditional programs or initiatives being tried, whether it's in Canada or around the world, that you're aware of that you think could be something good to try moving forward?
So there's other models of how safer supply is practiced in other countries and even within Canada. I think it's funny, people call it cutting edge, but really I just say it's respecting the person and that shouldn't be cutting edge. But there's other models such in like the UK and Switzerland who do, you know, more or less what we're doing in Canada, but with heroin-assisted treatment, whether that's in an injectable form or in a tablet form. And heroin has really, really, really good evidence behind it in terms of supporting people and you know, their opioid needs. There's a very similar program in the downtown east side at a clinic called Crosstown that is Canada's only prescribed heroin program. They serve about 200 people, if I get that number correct in my mind. And so that's innovative in a different way. They've been there for a long time. And we as safe supply prescribers would like to see that drug expand across all safer supply programs because heroin has a lot of benefits that we can't replicate in a much shorter acting drug like hydromorphone. So we are really, really hoping that, you know, the governments, both federal and provincial, will listen to that evidence, will listen to the needs of people who use drugs and actually fund that approach. Again, just because it's the right thing to do, but also, you know, we always hear about tax dollars, but that would, you know, the money invested in that type of program would pay itself back in spades.
I have a follow-up question regarding the program, and this is more of a case study or narrative, and I wanted your just experience on it, because you've sold me on this program. Public health field, I buy it, all the evidence is there. But for the individual who's not aware of this and what they consume in the media and the information and their whole war on drugs philosophy that has been hammered into our brains, we see drug seizures, and on the news you see that and you're like, nice, we're getting drugs off the market. But in reality, you know, we know that's just a drop in the bucket. How can we help inform policies with, you know, the evidence from your program to make a better sense of what is the actual reality of what is going on?
Absolutely. So government and policymakers need to listen to experts, and that doesn't need to mean medical experts or doctors. It means listening to the experts in their own substance use and people with lived experience. Everything in harm reduction that has saved lives have emerged from the minds of that community. Say, you know, needle exchange emerged in the 80s. It was illegal. The government said it was illegal. People were arrested for giving clean needles. Then we showed it worked. And, you know, doctors got behind that. And now doctors are giving clean needles. Safe consumption sites were illegal. They were started in back alleys and rooms on the downtown east side to save their friends' lives. It was illegal. People were thrown in jail for that. And then doctors like, oh, yeah, maybe this works. And they take it on. And doctors get famous for pioneering these safe consumption sites in their cities, when really it was an idea that came out of the community. And safe supply is exactly that. The community of people who use drugs have been screaming for it for 20 years, and we're only just listening now. This wasn't my idea. This was the community's idea. And, you know, I just have the power and the privilege to actually make it happen. And I'm grateful for that. But the idea is not from my head. And so policymakers actually need to involve people who are living these experiences, communities who are living these experiences, because we know that the actual solutions are going to come from, you know, consulting, involving those experts. We need government to recognize this is a health issue and not an opinion-based issue. There are only a few health issues that are, you know, really reliant on public opinion. You know, drug use and abortion are the most obvious ones. And it's all based on moralistic perceptions around them. So I always like to say, if a new diabetes drug comes out, do you have a community consultation on it, or do you follow the evidence and provide it to patients who can benefit? Do we actually have community polls and like town halls on the new diabetes drug? No, we don't. We listen to the evidence. And so why is safe supply and interventions to help people who use drugs be safer? Why do we, you know, care what the public thinks? And please take that in the way it's intended. But why are we having town halls on using this in a community? It is a evidence-based, successful approach to help reducing the health and social outcomes of people who use drugs. And any you know, development of these initiatives needs to be based on the evidence, and not what Karen writes into the newspaper.
I guess when we have a new blood pressure medication or something that's life-saving, we don't have a whole news release and applications. And mm-hmm. I mean, obviously the FDA and that sort of legal regulation happen, but the community is not consulted whether your local pharmacy is going to carry that drug.
Yeah, your MPP doesn't care about the new emerging therapy, right? Nor should they.
Right. That's interesting. So even the process of even implementing these solutions is a barrier itself, because there's that extra bit of consultation that comes from something that's already proven to be evidence-based. So why do we have to go through all those mechanisms? That's that's a question that we have to revisit. So we've come to the end here, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to we're talking about the drug poisoning crisis and understanding the challenges of the people experiencing drug poisoning. So I was wondering if you some takeaway messages for people who are listening and who will be listening. What are some things you don't want them to miss or just take away from just this conversation?
And what I want people to take away is not the drug I'm using, not the clinics that it's used in, not the referral process, but the approach of centering the person in their own care. And that's where I think Safer Supply is actually revolutionary, in that patients make their own goals. We support them in meeting that. We listen to their own experiences. We listen to their own expertise. And I think that should not just happen within Safer Supply or substance use. That should be happening in every single medical therapy, in any joint decision making. And we just need to consider again that people know their own lives better than we do, and we need to listen to them. So if the medical community, if the broader community can take anything from the Safer Supply approach, I would say it's that.
Thank you for listening to the Public Health Insight Podcast, your go-to space for informative conversations, inspiring community action. If you enjoy our content and would like to stay up to date, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. To learn more about our community initiatives and how you can support us, visit our website at thepublichealthinsight.com. Join the PHI community, and let's make public health viral.